Hello and welcome. It's early December. We're hurtling towards the end of 2017. We will be back next year as usual, of course, finding people twisting their arms to tell us their stories. And this is a good moment to ding the wine glass to let you know we have an addition to our team in the Conversations Salt Mine. I am excited, thrilled, and honoured to tell you that Sarah Kanofsky's agreed to come on board in 2018. I'll be with you next year on Mondays to Wednesdays, and Sarah will be here Thursdays and Fridays. Now, if you listen to this show a lot, you'll already know Sarah. She's filled in for me many times over the past few years and done alarmingly well. So, Sarah, hello and welcome to you officially.
I'm so happy to have my hard hat and my pick to join you in the salt mine, Richard.
Now, in a moment, we're going to hear your conversation from earlier this year with the great Jimmy Webb, the songwriter. But first, we already know a little bit about you, but not enough, quite frankly. And these are some of the unanswered questions we've had submitted to us by anxious listeners via email. So are you ready to go with this?
Hit me.
Okay. H. Bashakowski of Darwin would like to know, is your name really Polish, or is that something you just made up to make yourself look more glamorous?
Well, obviously it ends a certain European sophistication, which distinguishes me from the more common Fiedler. But no, it's true. The Kanofskis are a great and noble lineage that have been in Australia for quite some time, but I feel it makes me feel a bit Fellini-like on air, and that's what I think listeners pick up on.
Okay, R. Armstrong of Deception Bay wants to know, you come from a large Catholic family, one of seven kids. Where do you fit in the lineup of that?
Well, obviously, given my neuroses, sense of inadequacy, desperate seeking for attention, I'm number seven. The afterthought, the exclamation note, the mistake, depending on what time of the day you ask my mum.
So that meant you never got fed at the family table because the bigger kids would have gotten all the food?
You have noticed that I've got a somewhat stunted appearance, Richard. It could be a lack of protein early on in my life, which is responsible for this.
All right. Now, P. O'Brien of Downton Abbey would like to know, you studied at Oxford University. Wow, that's very impressive. Do you guys wear those caps and gowns all the time when you're walking across the quadrangle at Oxford?
So that's one of the disclosure statements that we sign once we're given entry to Oxford. We can't reveal that. We can't reveal. We have to speak in sort of special Harry Potter language when we're there at the sub-fusc. That's what it's called when you wear those special outfits.
What is it? It's called the what?
Sub-fusc.
What is that? Is that Latin?
I guess. Like, I went to a university in Australia first. I didn't learn any Latin. I was at a considerable disadvantage. But no, I studied English literature at Oxford. It was wonderful. And a Commonwealth scholarship, which means I got paid to be there. And my husband got paid for being my spouse while we were there. This is the glories of the university system in certain parts of the UK.
How come that's not illegal now? Has that happened or what?
Well, who knows? He used to supplement his income by doing lineups, police lineups. So it obviously needed a bit of a top up, but we had a base income courtesy of the Commonwealth.
Your husband? He used
Nigel,
to volunteer.
You got £10 cash in hand, and he'd go into a room and there'd be a group of people who looked sort of a bit like him, and they'd all stand around and be identified as a potential criminal. I was always scared he was going to get, you know, carted off to jail. Once he had to go and don a beard, that was the high point of the police lineup career that he's had. So, yes, it was a rich and varied experience at Oxford.
M. Ransom Hughes of Mooney Ponds would like to know, what kind of a reader are you? What do you like to read? How often do you read? Where do you read? That kind of thing.
Let's just say that when I go away with friends who are not used to me at home, there is sometimes cruel comments I feel made, like, put the book down, we're actually having dinner together, or, no, why are you there alone in the room? We want to talk. And, I mean, people are great conversations. I love the stories.
I'm going to jump right in here.
Okay, yeah.
Lee Sales has written about this, how annoyed she gets by people telling her to stop reading. This happens to her all the time, she says. And if she didn't read, she said she'd go mad. And I feel the same way.
Me too. And I think it's a union. If you're a reader like that, you know what that means. There's nothing like, for some people think that you sitting down with a book is an invitation to a conversation. It's not. I'm reading. I'm having the conversation with the book. So it's like, to me, it's a very clear sign. If I have a book on my lap, that's where my concentration is. So, yeah, I am a big reader and I love to read. That's one of the things I love about conversations is it brings a whole new world of books all the time.
Oh, yeah, it's actually a compulsion to read.
Yeah.
You have to read so much for this job. You have to read all the time.
You've ended up walking into polls due to your reading, I believe.
I have. I'm a bruised individual and I ought to probably call workers' compensation for that because I have walked into a couple of stop signs and no parking
signs.
Well,
I have excellent health and safety conditions when I read and I read in a stationary spot, often in the safety of my own home.
Okay, this is an important cultural question now. Game of Thrones or Grand Designs?
Why can't we have both?
No, don't do that. You got to pick one.
Come on, Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones. Yeah, I thought that. How about okay? Let's drop it down another notch. Game of Thrones or The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills?
Oh, Game of Thrones.
Okay, all right.
100%.
So that's where it bottoms out.
My trash indulgence is crappy women's magazines.
Ah, really?
So I know a lot about the royalty of sort of very obscure European aristocratic houses, like the dukes and kings and queens of, you know, what's that place that begins with an L that's sort of near Monaco? What's that?
Luxembourg, Liechtenstein.
Liechtenstein. Right. That's where I get a certain pleasure in my heart that nothing else meets. If I can just sit alone with a glass of champagne and read in-depth interviews with aristocrats from non-significant European states.
Finally, and this is something everyone wants to know around the office, you always have biscuits and lollies in your drawer. What's going on there? What's that about?
It has been pointed out to me that if, like, the world were to go into nuclear meltdown, I could probably survive just on the storehouses that I have in my bag and in my drawer for another couple of years. I just think it's good to be prepared. I like to know that I can get protein and sugar sources at all times, Richard.
It's pure pragmatism. That's all it is. Sarah, thank you very much. It's your conversation today with Jimmy Webb. So I'm just going to hand it over to you now to introduce the great Jimmy Webb.
Thanks, Richard. For these last few days of the program year, we're going to replay some of the most popular conversations from 2017. I was lucky enough to be on deck when Jimmy Webb was touring Australia a few months ago. Richard, a line man, by the time I get to Phoenix, up, up and away, MacArthur Park. Jimmy Webb had written all those classic songs by the age of just 23. And this is a roll call of some of the artists who've performed his songs: Glen Campbell, Frank Sinatra, Elvis Presley, Barbara Streisand, Donna Summer, Nina Simone, Nick Cave, and Kanye West. It's a pretty eclectic and impressive range. Jimmy Webb's written a memoir, and it's called, in a nod to his hit MacArthur Park, The Cake and the Rain. I spoke to Jimmy when he was touring Australia in June. Jimmy Webb, what a pleasure to welcome you to Conversations. Congratulations on this memoir, which is such fascinating reading. And at the back of it, Jimmy, there are pages of lists. There are, I think, 12 pages of artists who've recorded your songs. There's 2.5 pages of artists alone, and this is only a partial list, apparently, who've recorded MacArthur Park. How many songs do you think you've written?
You know, it's a good question. I would think around 400 or 500 or so, but it's really hard to tell because I've thrown a lot of them away. I've forgotten a lot of them. I may as well announce that I'm a senior citizen. I'm 70 years old, and some of the songs just don't come back as readily as they used to. So I'm not really sure how many there are, but there's enough to make several albums.
There's enough. You could always just look up at the back of the book to remind yourself. How did your parents get together, Jimmy?
They lived on opposite sides of the Cimarron River in southwestern Oklahoma before the Second World War. And my mother was a beauty, a raven-haired, blue-eyed, sort of a candidate. And my father was a sort of a dark horse from across the creek who came from a much poorer background. And I suppose they were an unlikely match, but they got together in a group called the Buffalo Quartet, which was a gospel singing group. And I have photos of them wearing their costumes. The ladies, my father's sister, wore almost like ballroom gowns. And the young men wore like checkered sports jackets, and they all matched. And there they are,
very
sort of
sharp,
singing together. And one thing led to another, and he abducted her one day.
Unexpected next sentence.
I mean, yeah, he sort of borrowed one of his uncle's pickup trucks, and went by the high school where she was.
He's still at high school.
And because he was going off to join the Marines, and they wanted to be married. And they went over to his uncle's house, and some sort of a ceremony was put together. This was all without the knowledge of her family. And then they got on a Greyhound bus and went to Wichita Falls, Texas, on the Greyhound bus. My dad said when they got there, the place was crawling with cops. That was I always loved that. I don't know, just the feeling of those words. It was crawling with cops. And they put him in jail.
How old was he? I mean, was he much older?
He was 17. She was 16.
And they put him in jail?
They put him in jail. He was my mother told her family that if they didn't get him out of jail, she would run away from home. And she meant it, and they knew she meant it. And so they all drove down to Wichita Falls and picked up my father and drove back. And I can only imagine what the atmosphere was like in the car on the way back. And then they all sat down and talked it out, and it was decided that they would let them be married. And so they, at the tender age of, 17 and 16, they were married.
Was it a great love story, or was it a kind of a teen infatuation?
No, it was a great love story. And my father talks about being at Camp Lejeune in Southern California, and mother lived in a little shack nearby because they didn't have, like, officers had housing, but not the enlisted guys. And they loaded them on the ships in a surprise strategic movement of some kind. They moved a whole army in one night, and they told all the guys not to get in contact with their loved ones because it would tip off the enemy. And so he's in the back of this truck, and he slipped his pocket knife out of his duffel bag, and he cut a hole in the side of the truck so he could see the house where Anne was.
Oh, my goodness.
And he didn't see her, but he saw the house. He saw the lights, and he didn't see her for 37 months.
What did he do for a living when he got back to the States?
When he got back, he tried to farm a little bit. He worked in the flour mill. He threw 50-pound sacks of flour. He stacked them. He told me 10 high. They'd lay one on, and then they'd build it up to 10 layers. And, it's one thing to say 50 pounds of flour, but if you really try to pick it up and throw it over your back and try throwing it up, like a basketball, you'll see what 50 pounds really is. And he worked like a dog, I think. And one day, my dad's driving the tractor, and this is his story. He says that the heavens opened up, and God came down and said, "Robert, get down off that tractor. You're going to be a preacher now." Saul on the road to Damascus, it's so biblical, And there was no doubting him. You didn't say, "Dad, that didn't really happen, did it?" No, but you just didn't dare say anything like that to him.
So he packed up his life and became a Baptist preacher.
Became a Baptist preacher, yeah.
Did that mean it was a restrictive kind of childhood for you, Jimmy, with a dad who was a preacher in these little tiny towns in Texas?
Well, not to put too fine a point on it, but we lived in a goldfish bowl. We were the preacher's kids, and we were told that we represented the family, and we represented the church. We were always had to be on our best behavior out in the community, which really made us, frankly, it made us like sitting ducks for those aggressive personalities, the people who wanted to pick on people and make fun of people and send people up. And of course, we were defenseless because we always had to behave exactly right. Or we would catch, I hate to use the expression, but we would catch hell when we got home.
Who introduced you to music?
When I was 6 years old, my mother said, "Jimmy, you're going to learn how to play the piano." She wanted me to be the church pianist. We had an agreement that if I played the piano for at least a half an hour every day, she wouldn't hit me with a stick.
Well, that sounds like a fair trade.
It worked out pretty well because when I was 12 years old, I became the sort of, for lack of a better term, the musical director, of this little church, and played the piano, played for the choir, played for funerals, played for weddings, played for evangelical missions with my father in the summer, and we would go out. And I had a knack for hymns. I could improvise the whole rhapsody around Amazing Grace. And he loved to show me off.
Did you love the piano straight away? Or was it something that there was the threat of that stick that kept you on the piano seat?
When I was 12, I didn't think much of the piano. I thought it had robbed me of a social life. It had kept me out of sports and things that I was more interested in or thought I was more interested in. And when I was 12, 13, 14, we were living in Oklahoma City, and all those chemicals and hormones and things began to run wild in my veins. And I realized fairly quickly that my knowledge of the piano was my passageway into social interaction, because up until that point, I was an outlier. I didn't talk to anybody. I ventured no opinions. I didn't put myself in a position to get in trouble because my father was the preacher. But girls liked piano playing. They liked hearing, you know, I had an ear, so I hear a song on the radio, I could play it on the piano.
Besides church music, which was informing your brain and your creativity at that time, what else were you listening to?
I loved rock and roll. I loved Elvis Presley, which we were not allowed to listen to.
So how did you then?
Well, because we had transistor radios. You know, people think that the internet was the first subversive instrument, you know, but they're wrong.
Because, so you'd sneak off some of it.
Of course. You could go wherever you wanted and listen to your own program, whatever it was. So, and I have to admit that my ear ran towards the kind of orchestral stuff, the kind of Bobby Vinton, Bobby V.
When did you first hear Glen Campbell singing?
I was 14 years old. I was driving a tractor up in northwest Oklahoma. I was plowing wheat. I was actually pulling a great big cultivator, and I was turning the wheat over because it was just the stubble, and I was turning it over so that we could plant a new crop. And I'm listening to my transistor radio, and I hear this beautiful song called Turn Around, Look at Me. And it's perfectly conceived, and the title's right, the lyrics are beautiful. But the thing that really grasped me was the vocal. And I heard this guy singing, and I, for the first time I heard his name, and somebody said, that's Glen Campbell, you know, with our, you know, hot platter of the week, you know. And it turned out that it was... I think he was cheated on that record, because I don't think Glenn ever thought it was really a big hit. But in my research, I see that it was a big hit.
What happened to that tractor that you were driving when Glenn came on the radio?
A small accident happened.
How small?
Yeah. Well, it was called a 20-foot one-way because you were only supposed to turn it one way. And... And in the excitement, I turned it the other way, and it stripped all, I had the plow up, and it stripped all the threads on the cultivator, and it dropped this 2-ton plow in my employer's front yard.
It's a bit like how your dad had a vision of God in front of his tractor.
Yeah,
you had
only
a vision
different,
of Glenn.
Only different. I plowed up the duck pond. The ducks are going every direction. And finally I thought there was nothing else mechanical that I could do except stop the tractor and get off and try to maintain my composure while he fired me. Oh, he fired me. He rightfully so.
Who introduced Glenn to your songwriting, Jimmy?
A very important person in my life was Johnny Rivers. At that particular time, he had some wonderful records of Memphis, Secret Agent Man. He had just written a song called Poor Side of Town that went to number one. And he was creating an album called Changes. And at that moment, I had crossed over from my mentorship at Motown Records, where I'd spent a couple of years. I wrote 45 songs there. I got a release on a Supremes album. these were some pretty important things, you know, for a kid to do. But it wasn't the hit single. It wasn't fame. It wasn't any of the things that I sort of thought I wanted. And I went over to Johnny's, and I had this song with me called By the Time We Get to Phoenix that I'd written for Paul Peterson. Paul Peterson was a regular on the Donna Reed show, and he'd had a couple of minor hits. He turned it down. He hated it. So they gave me the song. So when I went to Johnny Rivers, I had this song, By the Time I Get to Phoenix. Johnny listened to it, and he said, you know that's a hit. I said, no, I didn't know it was a hit. He says, that's a stone-cold hit. He said, I'm going to call this guy Glenn Campbell. All of a sudden, there was that name again, you know, Glenn Campbell. Because I'd been writing songs for Glenn Campbell ever since that day on the tractor. You know, I just wanted somehow or another to write those kind of songs. And Johnny called Al DeLore, who was Glenn's producer, and he came over, and they listened to By the Time I Get to Phoenix together. And Al DeLore looked at Johnny Rivers and said, I don't get it. He said, you know this is a hit. And Johnny Rivers said to Al, Al, you can only have one number one record at a time.
Don't be greedy.
Yeah. And actually what he was doing was he was doing me a favor as a writer and giving me a chance to have a hit record with the song.
I want to actually talk first a bit more about the second hit that Glenn Campbell had with one of your songs, which is Wichita Line Man. Uh-huh. How specific was he when he asked you to write that song? What did he want?
He called me up one afternoon and he said, Jimmy, I need a follow-up for By the Time I Get to Phoenix. And I said, well, okay. And I didn't really know him very well. He didn't approve of me. He didn't like my long hair and my hippie ways and, you know, the fact that I inhaled and all of this stuff he didn't like. So he sort of had me at arm's length. For instance, I was never on the Glenn Campbell show.
Truly?
Truly. He thinks I was. He used to say, remember when you were on my show? And I'd say, Glenn, I was never on your show.
I was too much of a hippie to be on your show.
Because I was too much of a hippie and you wouldn't let me be on your show. But he called me up and he said, do you think you could write me a song about a town? And I said, Glenn, you know, I'm like pretty much finished writing songs about towns, you know, saying, oh, well, that's too bad. He said, you think you could make it geographical? You know? And I thought about it and I said, well, maybe I could make it geographical. So I worked on it the rest of that afternoon. It was about 3 or 4 hours. And at the end of the day, I sent it over to them. And it was Wichita Lineman.
I am a lineman for the county, and I drive the main road, searching in the sun for another overload. I hear you singing in the wire, I can hear you through the whine. And the Wichita lineman is still on the line.
Jimmy, what instrument were you playing on that song that you were just telling me?
It was something that I had left over from my church days. It was a Gulbranson, a sort of a gimmicky organ that had like a lot of effects on it. And they would have different little names for them, like Telstar or Evening Chimes or Morning Star, or, you know, all these. You didn't actually know what they were, but when you held down the keys, they would make different effects, because this was before synthesizers.
Yeah.
So we found our effects and we found our gimmicks, if you will. We found them where we found them. And one night we were over at my house, and I was playing that little shivery sound that you hear at the end. And really, I was just holding down two fingers. I wasn't really doing it. And Glenn said, how are you doing that? How do you play that, man? I said, I'm not doing anything. I'm just holding down two keys and then moving them up and down, you know. And he said, well, we got to do that. He said, he called SIR, Studio Instrument Rental. He said, Shorty, get over here right now. He says, we got to move this organ. The thing weighed a ton. And they came with a big truck, and they moved it down to Ocean Recorders, or maybe it was Western, and one of the two probably. And we moved the organ into the studio, and he said, now just do what you did. Just do exactly what you did. I put my two fingers down on the organ right there on the fade as it goes out.
Yeah.
And you sort of hear this kind of shivering electronic effect.
And 44 million copies later, everyone else has heard that too.
44 million copies worldwide.
Yeah.
And he was very proud of that.
I want to ask you about that line, I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time, and the Wichita line man is still on the line.
Yeah.
How does that line stand up for you?
It's a false rhyme.
People love it.
Yeah, I know. I mean, a lot of years went by before I finally faced up to it, though, and I listened to it, and I thought, you know, it was probably after people started saying, you know, that's a great line. We love that line. It's a great line. I actually have it on the back of one of my T-shirts that I sell at my concert.
Oh, really?
But time doesn't rhyme with line.
But it's still a beautiful line, surely. It doesn't matter if it's a false rhyme, does it, really?
There are certain places where it does matter. It matters in the Broadway arena. It matters a lot because critics will rip you to pieces for writing false rhymes. And I think as you get older and you get more persnickety about the things you're doing, that you kind of don't want to write false rhymes, you know. That being said, I think that some of the best writers in the world have written one or two false rhymes in their time. It's kind of an unavoidable disaster, you know.
Well, isn't it that like in a Persian rug, there's meant to be one tiny mistake that makes the whole rug perfect?
I love that analogy. I'm going to embrace that.
When you were inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame, what did Billy Joel, your friend, say about that song?
Oh, God, you surprised me with that one. He broke me up because he had spent most of the evening, because he's really very funny and very, very comical at the piano. And he was saying like things like, I need you more than want you. He said, I mean, that sounds like a diss. And then he says, but then he says, and I want you for all time. Jeez, he really does love her. You know, he was doing...
This is Conversations on ABC Radio.
Your dad, as a preacher, moved the family around a lot. And at one point you moved to Southern California. And after moving there, your mum got sick. Tell me about that point in your life.
Well, up until that point, we had really been, in many ways, though we were rather poor, we weren't poverty-stricken. We got by with very little money, and we were very happy. We went on vacations and in the car, and my father would take $100 out of the bank and drive us to Michigan to see the Ford plant.
Really? You know?
Yes, really. And so, I mean, we made our own fun, and she was always there. She was always a part of it. And she was 36 years old. He had taken this new church in California. This was really a dream come true. I had a brand new organ, a huge thing that I'd purchased for the church. And we were settled into school, and everything was going pretty well in the spring of 1964. It was my senior year. Spring of 1963, my senior year. And my mother fell over a piece of furniture in the living room. And it just seemed like a silly household accident. But my father took her down, and they started checking her for dizziness and what have you. And so, to make a long story short, they discovered an inoperable brain tumor And 5 weeks later, my mother passed away on the operating table. And so this was like dropping a nuclear weapon inside the perfect American family, faith-based family. And my father, to really be honest with you, my father lived to be 92 years old, but he never recovered from that. The rest of his life was a reverberation. It was an echo of my mother. And the rest of us tended to disassociate because it was so brutal. It was so quick. Mm. And I remember one of the things that he told us before the funeral ceremony. There were two funerals, one in California and one in her home state. And before the funeral in California, he called us all into his office. And all these little girls, there were three girls, and my youngest sisters were 4 and 6. And then there was my brother Tommy, and who was a big, stalwart, athletic guy, and my sis Jan, and me, the oldest. And we're sitting there all in our finery in front of him, and he said, "All right, kids," he said, "let's go out there and show them how the webs bury their dead. I don't want to hear any sniveling or snot dropping. I don't want to hear any crying. I don't want any tears." He said, "Just keep it buttoned up." And
there's nothing subtle about that, is
and,
there? Wow.
And we were pretty much conditioned to do what Dad said. Dad was a big, authoritative, very, very handsome, and also could be kind, could be the orator of all time, but had this U.S. Marine tucked away inside, which would come out occasionally. And this was the U.S. Marine, right? And so somehow or another, the rest of it is like, to me, it's like a dream. I can't remember what happened after Dad said that. Mm. It was just, I'm not even gonna go into some of the more macabre things that I thought, but it was like dreamlike.
Was music a kind of refuge for you in the emotional fallout from that sudden loss of your
mom? I could control music. I could make it do what I wanted it to do. Obviously, I couldn't control life. I couldn't control death. I couldn't control the world with all its machinations and all its complications. But there was this world that I did have, what I would deem to be a certain mastery over. And that was all the notes between the octaves and the way they fit together and the way I could make them work and the way, and this was before I went up to Hollywood. This is before I got a job at Motown. We hung on there for a few months. He tried to preach. And finally, my father said, "I can't preach anymore." And that's when he went back to, packed up the station wagon and took the whole family except for my sister and I. We stayed, but the rest of them went back. And
why did you stay?
I had come a long way to meet Glenn Campbell. You know, and it was only 1 hour from San Bernardino to Hollywood. And I could smell the hot vinyl. You know, there was nothing was going to call that dog off that hunt. You know what I mean? And I told my dad, I said, "Dad, I can't go with you." And he was standing there beside the station wagon and waiting for me to put my stuff on. And I said, "I just thought about it a lot, and I just can't get in the car and face Route 66 and that long, long drive across New Mexico and Arizona. I can't do that." And he said, "Well, son," you know, he says, "this is the hardest thing I've ever done." And he reached in his pocket and handed me all the money he had, and it was about $40. And he said, "Son, this songwriting thing, it's just going to break your heart." Sort of turned on his heel, and I think he saw a little tear, unless I'm mistaken.
It must have taken a lot of courage for you to stay at that point, to know yourself well enough, Jimmy.
Well, I didn't know it was courage, but I knew that I couldn't go back. I knew that. I think that now I look back and I say, hey, that was pretty feisty for a 17-year-old kid, you know. And they drove off, and I'm standing there in the middle of California all by myself with nothing but my good name and the little talent that God had given me and that my mother had cultivated. And I think that I thought the best way I can serve my mother now is to take what she taught me and try to do something with it.
I want us to play you singing the song that you mentioned before, the first hit that Glen Campbell had with By the Time I Get to Phoenix. Before I play that, just give us a little introduction to that song. What's that story about for you when you were writing this work?
Well, that was Susie Horton. You know, there was a girl. She was my childhood, you know, sweetheart. And more accurately, she was my senior year sweetheart. And we went to grad night at Disneyland together, and she was a homecoming queen. She was everything. She was captain of the cheerleaders, and I was this nebbish. I was this nerd with thick glasses, and somehow or another, she was like an angel. She reached down and she touched me with her greatness and her beauty and saved me somehow. And so I was in love with her. And she wasn't in love with me, but I was in love with her. And so a lot of songs came out of that.
By the time I get to Phoenix, she will be rising. She'll find the note that I left hanging on her door. She'll laugh when she reads the part that says I'm leaving. 'Cause I've left that girl, oh, too many times before.
And that very stripped back version comes off Jimmy's solo album 10 Easy Pieces, which was released in 1996. Jimmy, someone came up to you after a gig one night and took you to task about the geography of that song. What was their complaint, do you remember?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, you have these sort of Cal Poly types, you know, these engineers or jet propulsion laboratory types, I call them. And they this guy came rushing into my dressing room, and although I'm usually surrounded by three rings of armored security officers, actually, I have no security whatsoever, never have had any. This guy comes rushing into my dressing room with a red face, and he says, "You've got it all wrong." He says, "There's no way you could possibly do that." He said, and he had a map, and he flopped the map down. He had a stopwatch, and he had a pen protector, and he got his pen out, and he got his slide rule, and he said, "Even if you drove 200 miles an hour between, you know, Phoenix and Albuquerque, you'd never be there in time for her to go to work the next day." And he's like, he's off on a tangent, you know. He said, "You know, you're violating the time-space continuum, you know, and all this stuff." Lord knows, I wouldn't want to violate the time-space continuum. I mean, I've done some bad things, but I don't want to do that. And so I said, "What's your name?" He said, "Joe." I said, "Joe." I said, sit down. And he sort of looked at me, kind of stopped him, and he sat down. And I said, "Would somebody get Joe a Southern Comfort?" And somebody did. And I said, "Now, Joe, I want to tell you something. It's just a song." That's all it is. It's just a song. And he had his Southern Comfort, and he calmed down, and I think everything was okay
after
that.
You introduced the concept of poetry into that young man's life, and it's probably never been the same since, Jimmy. With the huge success of those songs that Glenn sang, and then other artists, you know, you made a lot of money and you got a lot of fame very, very young. There are a lot of sports cars. Some pretty amazing looking sports cars. And you bought a big house in LA and had a stained glass window in the lounge room.
I bought the house that Phil Harris built for Alice Faye. It was a Spanish hacienda. So it was really a piece of Hollywood history. And I had the stained glass windows in there were all my personal idols. The Beatles were there. Paul and Artie were there. Joni Mitchell and Bob Dylan was there. And these there were two of the panels, and they were as big as that. Each one was as big as that wall, that whole wall. And as time went by, I came to know all those people. And then eventually, after I got married, my first wife, one of the first things she said was, the stained glass windows have to go.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And somehow they were taken out of the house, and I was under the impression that I was donating them to UCLA and that they were going to use them in the student center. But something very, very bizarre happened. Those windows disappeared.
I think if anyone's got them, they need to contact us.
Utterly disappeared. And I have a picture of them in my book. I think there's one of them. And even though it's in black and white, you can see that it's all this lustrous, you know, glass. And I'm thinking that maybe someone might contact me and say, you know, I've seen that window, you know.
Well, one of the figures on that window was Joni Mitchell. Tell me about the time that she came to your house along with the L.A. Philharmonic.
Well, there were a bunch of players from the Philharmonic who lived out in Topanga Canyon, and my guitar player, Freddie Tackett, and his wife, Patricia, lived out there. And they were very much into the artsy scene, almost too much into the artsy scene. She was a kind of modern-day Isadora Duncan. And Patricia was, her nickname was Oceana. And the reason was that when she set her mind on something, it was like holding back the ocean. Well, the idea was that we were going to have a nude concert.
Of course.
And we were going to and I would have never thought of this. I could have lived my whole life quite happily and never thought of this thought. But she and I said, "Well, I don't know. How practical is that, you know?" And the first thing I know, you know, she set the date and she's got the members of, make this clear, members of the LA Philharmonic. She's got them all lined up to come take their clothes off and play. And then there's little consorts, there's little groups. There's a quartet, and there's an oboist and a pianist. And there are little sort of fragments of the orchestra that are split off into other and placed in. It was 6 acres, this yard. And so there's plenty of room to have different things going on at the same time. And the only prerequisite was that when you arrived, you had to take your clothes off. So I remember when the phone rang in the kitchen, and the property was crawling with nude musicians. There was one lady who was blessedly pregnant. She was a cellist. we cut her some slack. We let her wear a skirt. Okay, so at one point, the phone rang, and it was David Geffen. And I said, "Oh, hi, Dave." He says, "What's going on?" I said, nothing. Nothing, really. Just an ordinary day in paradise." He said, "Well, good." He says, "I was thinking maybe Joni and I will come over." I said, "Joni will come over." "Oh, Joni will come. Oh, that'd be wonderful if Joni came over." And I'm looking around me, and I'm thinking, how is this really, really going to work?
Did you know her already?
Yeah, I knew her. And I said, "David," I said, "there's dress code." And he said, "Dress code? Wow, that's you never heard that in Hollywood. What kind of dress code?" And I said, "No dress." And they came over anyway. And I greeted him down by the kitchen because that was the disrobing room. And Joni and David came into the kitchen and they took their clothes off. You know, and it was hysterical then. I have to refer you to the book because it...
There are details are, we won't get into.
Parts of
now
it are slightly indelicate. But there were no real harm done.
No real harm done. And you, your relationship with Joni Mitchell is a really sweet part of the story that you tell in the book. She was really close.
We were close friends, and I was enthralled, really, with her. I sort of fell in love with her, almost literally, physically, emotionally, when she played the troubadour. And I just went down there out of curiosity, and I stood up in the balcony and I looked down, and this little Canadian gal with blonde hair and blue eyes came on and started singing the biggest songs I'd ever heard in my life, one after another, and my mouth is just hanging open. And I knew that night that it was going to change my writing. And I wrote her a letter.
How did it change your writing?
Joni brought in a different style of writing, a conversational tone where lyrics were no longer flowery and formal. And she, her chord structures, the way she had a jazz influence, but clearly she came from admiration for rock. And she was a folk musician but all of these things sort of came together in her and redefined American songwriting. Everyone, Alanis Morissette will tell you that her favorite writer was Joni Mitchell, and almost everybody else will too. And I'll tell you, she was my favorite writer. And so I wrote her this letter, and it wasn't passionate. I was trying to hold back, but I was writing her a sweet letter, and I sent flowers, and I never heard back. And years later, she came up to me at a party, and she said, "You know," she said, "I was moving house today. She said, I was moving my house out of Topanga Canyon. I'm moving over to so and so," and she said, "I moved my couch in my living room," and she said, "I found a letter from you behind the couch," and it was there.
That letter.
It was unsealed, and she read it, and she. And she smiled at me and she said, "I'd love to go out and have some tea with you sometime." You know, I mean, and it sort of inspired one of my songs called Simile. And the first line goes, "This is the answer to the letter unsent that even so arrived some years later." You know, because it was like a distortion in time. It was like I had poured out all this stuff to her and gotten no reply and sort of gone through that rejection, but it didn't actually happen that way. She never saw the letter. It was somehow behind the couch.
But like most other things that have happened to you in your life, Jimmy, you managed to write a song out of it.
I wonder how often life is affected by those kinds of things, though.
The letters unread.
We think that it's cause and effect, but what if it's not? What if it's cause and no effect? And you never really know why you didn't get a reply. You know what I mean?
Your dad, you mentioned, was unsure about you taking up this whole songwriting gig.
He didn't like it.
Did that change after you introduced him to Frank Sinatra?
Well, Dad came around. He actually helped me a lot when Station KOMA in Oklahoma City was going to discontinue play on Up, Up, and Away because they said it was a song about drugs. And I called my dad because my heart was broken. And I'm not saying that I didn't eventually get into drugs, but drugs didn't have anything to do with Up, Up, and Away. And it was very, very early in my songwriting career. And it was very unfair of them to take my record off the air, the Fifth Dimensions version. He drove down to the station with his 45 and his Bible and had a talk with the program director.
Did that convince him to see differently?
He kept the record on the air, and I think it. My father was quite a formidable man. You didn't want him to be on your side. And I think that it had an effect on my career, because if that record had been taken off the air because it was about drugs, which it wasn't, it was about balloons. I wish it was about something serious and sort of social or philosophical, but it wasn't. It was just balloons.
Jimmy Webb, it has been such a honor to speak with you.
Oh, thank you.
And Jimmy Webb's new memoir is called The Cake and the Rain, which, of course, is a line from one of those many hits that we've been discussing. We hadn't even get a chance to get on to MacArthur Park.
That might be a good thing.
I spoke to Jimmy Webb when he was touring Australia in June, and that conversation will be back up on our website soon, abc.net.au/conversations. And you can find conversations there going back years and years. It's such a great treasure trove if you're doing some long drives this summer or just hanging out at the beach or at home. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Sarah Kanoski.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.